I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is former Vice President Al Gore, whose latest book is An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, a companion to the documentary film of the same name directed by Bay Area filmmakers Bonnie Cohen and John Schenck. Al Gore is joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart. And now join Marcy Glazer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Al Gore and Roy Eisenhart.
Former Vice President Al Gore was the 45th Vice President of the United States. He is the co-founder and chairman of Generation Investment Management, a senior partner at Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, and a member of Apple Inc.'s board of directors. He spends the majority of his time as chairman of the Climate Reality Project, a nonprofit devoted to solving the climate crisis for future generations. As all of you know, hopefully, Mr. Gore was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives four times, beginning in 1976, and twice to the U.S. Senate from the great state of Tennessee, beginning in 1984. He was elected the 45th Vice President in 1992 and served for 8 years. During the Clinton administration, Vice President Gore was a central member of President Clinton's economic team, served as the President of the Senate, a cabinet member, a member of the National Security Council, and as the leader of a wide range of important initiatives. He is, of course, the author of bestsellers Earth in the Balance, An Inconvenient Truth, The Assault on Reason, Our Choice, and most recently, An Inconvenient Truth. He is also the co-recipient with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change of the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize for informing the world of the dangers posed by climate change. Appearing in conversation with Mr. Gore is Roy Eisenhart, retired attorney, former executive director of the California Academy of Sciences, and frequent onstage visitor for us and for City Arts and Lectures. Please join me in welcoming former Vice President Al Gore and Roy Eisenhart to our stage.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Welcome, please.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This is friendly country.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much for that warm welcome. And before you get started, Roy, I want to take the opportunity to thank Marcy Glazer, the CEO of the San Francisco JCC, and also 70 Singer, the director. They've worked hard to make this a really nice event, and I'm really happy to be here. And you've done so much for this city, Roy. It's an honor to be interviewed by you.
Well, that's my pleasure, believe me, and I trust it's the audience's pleasure as well. I want to go right to it because there's so much to cover, and we will be talking mostly about your book and about the movie, and the good news is we will be screening the movie immediately
Great.
After we finish our conversation.
Let me interject on the movie. The credit for this movie, I think they've done an amazing job, goes to two directors, two San Francisco filmmakers, Bonnie Cohen and John Schenck, so Great. All credit to them.
Yeah, I would underscore that. We're so used to documentaries with exhaustive talking heads, and this movie, this documentary just moves and moves and moves, and it lives up to the importance of the issue we're talking about. 2017, it's not been a great year for optimism, right?
Mm.
particularly with regard to environmental issues at the national level. But today, you're going to make the case for optimism, right? And I think that
that's not a laugh line, by the way.
No.
Oh, my God, it's worse than I thought.
Okay. It's a...
optimism, ha, ha, ha.
It's a promise.
I understand.
And I guess the place to start with that case is to talk about what has happened in the decade from your original movie to your motivation to create both the sequel in the book and in the second movie. That's just a 10-year gap. What changed?
Well, there have been two big changes among the many. One is, unfortunately, the manifestations of the climate crisis have obviously gotten a lot worse and a lot more frequent, as the scientists have been warning us they would. Just today, the fires in Los Angeles County and Ventura County, and now they just now got started in San Diego County off to the east. And as those of you who live in California know better than I do, the Santa Anas are this year at the speed of Category 1 hurricane force winds, and so the fire marshals say once it gets started, they really can't do that much. It's really, really scary, and this is on the heels of the fires in Napa and Sonoma and surrounding areas earlier in the year, the smoke covering, so you had ash coming down your chimney, right?
Exactly. Yeah, opposite direction.
coming
down the chimney.
You want Santa Claus. You don't want ash coming down there. And I have three loved ones in California. One daughter is just making the decision whether or not to evacuate from Santa Barbara County. My young granddaughter is in the smoke there, and the fires may, who knows where they'll head. And another daughter in Los Angeles who appears to be safe, but these are so unpredictable, and my significant other in San Diego County, it's really a reminder. And, this is also the year of Hurricane Harvey.
Right.
Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Maria. Harvey dropped 5 feet of rain on Houston, Texas. The full flow of Niagara Falls for more than 500 days fell on Texas and Louisiana and some of it to the points north in only 5 days. It's truly remarkable. And there are reasons for all this that the scientists, the climate scientists, have explained in some detail. The same week Houston was hit so hard, there were almost 10 times as many victims in South Asia. One-third of Bangladesh was underwater. An extra 50 centimeters of rain in Mumbai and parts of eastern India from the over and above the normal monsoon. 100,000 homes devastated in Nigeria. All that same week. Fires here were mirrored by fires in Portugal and Spain and Italy and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. The biggest fires are in the Arctic and in Siberia, and they don't get on the news. And unfortunately, the list goes on. So 2017 has been a year thus far, and it's not over yet, where Mother Nature is speaking up very loudly, reinforcing the scientific consensus. Now, there is reason for optimism, even in 2017. We have remarkable developments, some of them due to work done here in Northern California, in the Silicon Valley area, from San Francisco to San Jose, with the cost reduction curves. That's a mouthful, but we're all familiar with what these tech geniuses have been doing over the last few decades. We saw it with computer chips and smartphones and flat-screen TVs and all kinds of other genomic sequencing. But the good news is that same phenomenon is appearing with solar energy, costs coming down very fast, wind energy, batteries. Elon Musk just installed the largest battery in the world in South Australia last week and turned it on. Another 26% reduction in the cost of lithium-ion batteries this year, coming down so rapidly. Electric cars, every automobile manufacturer in the world is now moving to electric vehicles. India has Since the Paris Agreement, India has really changed dramatically. They've just announced that within only 13 years, 100% of all the new cars and trucks in India will have to be electric vehicles. It's a great development.
And I don't want to interrupt, but I just point out that narrative is very well made in the movie, and I recommend people watch
it. Well, thank you very much. Yeah. Some of these events have happened since the movie, but lots of countries are phasing out the internal combustion engine. We are in the early stages of a global sustainability revolution, which has the magnitude of the industrial revolution, but the speed of the digital revolution. And it's empowered by the new digital tools, including the Internet of Things and machine learning, and CEOs and executive teams are acquiring the ability to manage electrons and atoms and molecules with the same precision that we've come to understand the networking and computer companies can manage bits of information. So it's a race. The problem's getting worse, but the solutions are gaining momentum.
Yeah. What I don't get is why this is such a political problem.
Yeah. Yeah. In Tennessee, where I live, there's an old saying among the farmers that if you see a turtle on top of a fence post, you can be pretty sure it didn't get there by itself.
Yeah.
And when you see climate made into a divisive political issue, that didn't happen by itself. Right. There was an intentional effort to use it as a wedge issue and to drive the polarization. Mm-hmm. We all remember that the Republican Party used to be an environmental party. Mm-hmm. Teddy Roosevelt was the greatest environmentalist ever in the White House, and Richard Nixon for all of the
stuff.
thank you, Roy. Created the EPA and the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, and when Barack Obama was elected, in January of his first term, the Koch brothers and others financed this Tea Party movement, and it had lots of allies. And there was a very deliberate effort to be misleading about the climate crisis. It's a hoax invented by the Chinese, they said, and all kinds of other crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. But it became a kind of a political tribal issue where you wore one badge that said I'm, you know, anti Obama, anti all this, and it enforced a kind of an orthodoxy of opposition to anything environmental. And of course, it was financed, but some of it was tapping into the well-known unhappiness and anger about some of the global economic trends, and we can get into that if you want, but everybody knows middle income wages have been stagnant for decades now. And this is not a uniquely American phenomena. This wave of populist authoritarianism has been manifest in other countries as well.
Particularly Europe.
In Europe particularly, but also in the Philippines and not to mention Russia. And other places.
Yeah. Well, but we have a process in place we call the democratic process.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't that be a leveler against particular self-interest of some people who want to throw a lot of money at to obfuscate a problem?
Yeah, it's a great question. And first of all, in some respects, it is. The courts have blocked some of what this new administration wants to do. The Congress has refused to go along with much of it, although their resistance seems to be fading of late. And the elections for governor in Virginia and New Jersey are indications that maybe there is a lot of moxie in this self-correcting mechanism. We'll see.
Yeah.
My favorite outcome was a down-ballot race in Virginia for the House of Delegates, where the transgender woman defeated the author of the bathroom.
Exactly.
Great. And now I see where one of the men who married each other over the objections of that county clerk in Kentucky is running against her.
Right.
So we'll see.
Yeah.
I don't know. But
that's your next book.
Well, but let me give you a deeper answer to your question.
Yeah.
I think that we do have a democracy crisis, and the roots are deep. When our country was founded, it was in an era of where the printing press was dominant in all forms of communication, and it created an information ecosystem, if you will permit me to use such a geeky term, that had characteristics beneficial to democracy. Individuals had very low entry barriers to enter the general conversation in the public square, the virtual public square. Ideas were more important. The way we determine what is more likely than not to be true depended upon the masses of the literate kind of making a general assessment, and that became a force in politics, enabling us to harvest the wisdom of crowds, a real phenomenon, make better decisions than any other nation on earth. In the last third of the 20th century, electronic media became dominant, and that started the demise of so many newspapers and magazines, still an ongoing process. And all of a sudden, there were gatekeepers that charged a lot of money for the privilege of entering the virtual public forum that most people paid attention to.
Right.
And so corporate entities and those with recurring large revenue streams could buy the privilege of dominating the public conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had these odd situations where you take two issues, the inheritance tax on less than 0.1% of the American people, and tens of millions of people have no health care. Which is more important to the Congress? Oh, well, the inheritance tax, of course. And we see in this tax bill that has gone to the conference committee the clear and definitive choice to serve the interests of donors of campaign money over the interests of what is almost certainly in the best interests of the general public. We don't even know what's going to be in this bill yet. Most of those who voted for it didn't know. And now, when the electronic media took over, that really hurt the quality of the public conversation. I want to give you one reference to a philosopher, the so-called Frankfurt School of Philosophy in Germany. They started before World War II, escaped during the war, went back in the 1950s, and a man named Jürgen Habermas wrote about this change in the public sphere and the communication. And his mentor was a man named Theodor Adorno, and he did a kind of a moral autopsy of the Third Reich, and he identified what he said was the first step on the descent into hell in Germany. And he wrote this sentence. He said, "All questions of truth were converted into questions of power."
Yeah.
And that conversion, he continued, attacked the very distinction between what is true and what is false. And we see in our country today, I'm not making the direct analogy to National Socialism, please don't let me seem to go that far, but we see today an organized, forceful, continuing attack on the distinction between what is true and what is false, with the conscious, repeated assertion of falsehoods with great emphasis and with money powering the repetition of the falsehood, seeming to indicate that those doing it are vulnerable to the idea that questions of truth are questions of power.
Yeah.
You're listening to former Vice President Al Gore, whose latest book is An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, a companion to the documentary film of the same name. He's joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Now, just to finish briefly, I'm sorry to take so long, Roy.
No, this is a key point.
The just as electronic media overtook the printing press, now we see social media and the internet-based forms of media. A report just a couple of days ago showed the widening gap of advertising online compared to advertising on television in all its forms. And we've all been a little bit disheartened by the fake news and the echo chambers and the Russian bots and this assault on our ability to think and reason together. But in spite of those problems, I still do believe that there is great potential in these new forms of communication to once again empower individuals to use the best available evidence and the ability to reason together to assert what's more likely to be true than not as the basis for decisions going forward. Every reform movement in our country lives and breathes on the internet. It's gaining power. The Indivisible Movement is one of many examples of how people can organize online and then actually meet one another personally and do the traditional kind of organizing to use the strength in numbers. So. We're not there yet by any means, but I do think there is hope.
Well, I'm going to focus still on truth because that's a key part of the title to your book. And it's always been the assumption that truth was kind of our compass pointing towards true north. So in addition to the power of control over media outlets and so forth, it strikes me another technique that gets utilized, particularly in your field, is attacking the messenger.
Yeah.
And specifically the climate scientist.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could address that.
Yeah, and that that really peaked in 2009, in the first year of Barack Obama's presidency, during the lead up to what had been hoped would be a decisive international conference held that year in Copenhagen in December. And in the lead up to that, the emails of a large group of climate scientists working out of England were hacked, and they took misleading excerpts and twisted them and really did a tremendous amount of damage to those messengers of what they believe and had really worked hard to demonstrate was scientifically valid. But the attack on the scientists had begun long before then. In the first movie that I was associated with, An Inconvenient Truth, and the book of the same title, I talked extensively about scientists who were censored, who were attacked as greedy for federal funding, and therefore they're making up lies in order to get grants. You know, there are thousands of these scientists in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, who have devoted untold numbers of amounts of their life on a volunteer basis to create this magnificent global research enterprise, which has formed the basis for our understanding of it. and for them to be attacked. Of course, it's not new
No.
for people who don't like a particular truth to attack the messenger. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
went through that, Mahatma Gandhi, and you can go right down mm-hmm. the list in every great reform movement that has advanced the fortunes of humankind. Those who have led it have been subjected almost always to, yeah. to withering personal attacks.
No, it's just the dishonesty with which the facts are twisted now.
Yeah. Shamelessly.
It's shameless. And in that regard, we were told that the Paris Climate Accord was a terrible deal, terrible for jobs and our economy. And so now we are the only country in the world, because Syria just signed on,
right.
not to be members of the Climate
yeah.
Accord.
Yeah. So, Syria got its act together before yeah. we did. And Nicaragua was the other holdout.
Yeah,
they're now
right.
on board. But there are a couple things to remember about the U.S. participation in the mm-hmm. Paris Agreement. Yes, Donald Trump has said he wants to take the U.S. out. But a lot of people are not aware that this agreement was written pretty carefully. And the first day after the notice period and the delay and so forth, the first day upon which the U.S. could legally withdraw from the Paris Agreement happens to be the first day after the next presidential election in 2020.
Yeah.
And
November 4th. Yeah.
And if there is a new president, excuse yeah. me for a moment. I didn't say a partisan word.
No.
A new president could simply give 30 days' notice, mm-hmm. and the U.S. would be right back in the agreement.
Yeah.
More importantly,
yeah.
In spite of Donald Trump's speech, Governor Jerry Brown here in California, God right. bless him, he is just great. And Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York, Jay Inslee in the state of Washington, the three of them started this movement among states, and there are now 15 states, hundreds of cities, hundreds of universities, thousands of businesses, many of them in California, who have all said, we're still in the Paris Agreement, hashtag we got this.
Right.
And the projections now indicate that the U.S. is going to meet and exceed our commitments mm-hmm. under the Paris Agreement, regardless of what President Trump tweets or right. says or does. Now, we need to move faster, and we could if we had the right policies in place. Instead, President Trump's proposing massive new and additional subsidies for coal and other fossil fuels mm-hmm. and is proposing in this tax bill to slash the meager encouragements for renewables. But, you know, these technological trends and the business imperatives are driving this anyway. And where jobs are concerned, Roy, the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out with its annual report a few weeks ago. Solar jobs are now growing 17 times faster
right.
than all other jobs in the economy, mm-hmm. by far the fastest growing job category. The second fastest growing job category is wind turbine technician. Mm-hmm. And then there's a fall off after that. If you collect together all of the energy efficiency jobs, upgrading buildings with better mm-hmm. windows and lighting and insulation, LEDs take just a fraction of the energy, and within 6, 7, 8 years, they're predicted to take over virtually 100% of the global mm-hmm. lighting market. It's part of this sustainability revolution. I think we've seen a decoupling of CO2 emissions and economic progress. So, again, we need to move faster, and we need better policy. And so these elections coming up next year for the Congress, a lot's at stake.
Right. I was wondering, in those elections, it could well be that with reentry into the Paris Accord could be a strong Democratic plank for those.
Yes, I
elections.
Hope so. I hope yeah. so. This effort to promote climate denial on mm-hmm. the basis of false evidence has had an impact on the political dialogue. And the news media has not done its job, let me say. There's been an odd result in the public opinion polling for years now. And there are two results that seem anomalous. Number one, 71% in the latest poll of American people agree the climate crisis is real, man-made, we have to do something about it. That's really great. A majority of Republican voters agree. A plurality of Trump voters agree. But the other result is, when you give people a list of 15 or 20 problems to be addressed and ask them to rank them in order of urgency, the climate crisis typically comes near the bottom of the list. Now, why is that? There was a great book came out a few years ago. I'm sure many of you read it, called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow by Daniel Kahneman. And one of the many insights that he and his colleagues have given us from neuroscience is that recent memories take precedence over more distant memories. And if you hear about something, if you've heard about something recently, if you hear about it frequently, then it occupies a more dominant place in your awareness. Naturally, it's common sense, but there's science behind it. So we just came through the third presidential election cycle in a row where not one single question was asked of any of the candidates in the debates about the climate crisis. Odd. And these organizations that analyze the content of news programs, they took the mainstream media and added up for the entire calendar year of 2016, maybe it'll be different this year, the aggregate total amount of time on the major mainstream news media news programs devoted to climate for 365 days among all three of the major networks was 45 minutes. 45 minutes for the entire year. And, you know, I mean, every night now is like a nature hike through the Book of Revelation. You know, it's just like, I mean, you know, you went, oh, you know. And yet almost never are the dots connected. And so there are people, social scientists, who've done what they call regression analysis to discern what factors influence this result of it being down the scale of urgency. And the one factor that pops out in all these studies is it's not on the news. It's not being covered. And it's hard to change that because the line between news and entertainment has been eroded. The days of Walter Cronkite are over, evidently. And these news divisions are now part of a network that's part of a conglomerate, and everything is aimed at the bottom line. And if they do studies showing that some fraction of their audience changes the channel if they mention climate because they fly into a rage, then they have an incentive not to cover it. And that may be too simplistic an analysis, but I don't think so. It's a little like a dysfunctional family with an alcoholic father who flies into a rage if the word alcohol is mentioned, so the whole family kind of tiptoes around the gorilla in the middle of the dining room table and never mentions what will trigger a rage. And I think that the inducement of this climate-related rage on the part of those that wear the tribal badge, we think it's a hoax, they just... I think it influences the news media's decision to hardly ever mention it. I'm hopeful that's changing.
But the news media is willing to give wall-to-wall coverage on hurricanes, floods, typhoons, fires. And it seems that's
the tempest-tossed anchorman, yes.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a backdoor into what I'll call not climate science, but climate common sense.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think people are connecting the dots on their own. I really do.
But that has to manifest itself in such a way that it gets out of this political division, because as we started about on this topic, I looked at a recent Gallup poll, and 66% of the Democrats put climate issues at near the top of their concerns.
Yeah.
18% of Republicans think of it as a problem.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, the year 2000, forget other things
that
happened
that year.
In 2000. 26% of Republicans thought climate change.
Yeah.
So we actually see a disconnect in logical thinking going like this. So I'm looking for mechanisms, and I think that's what you're coming up with.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to go to, is things like your 24-hour climate reality program.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, because that's the way people are going to start to think about this in a new way.
Yeah, well, thank you. The Climate Reality Project that I set up with the proceeds of the Nobel Prize that Marcy was kind enough to mention 11 years ago holds an annual event called 24 Hours of Reality. We also hold training programs for climate activists. We had one here in San Francisco several years ago. We just had one in Seattle. We have the next one in Mexico City. We've had them in Johannesburg and Delhi and Beijing and Shenzhen and all over the world. And we go through 3 days of intensive training. But each year, near the end of the year, we have an event called 24 Hours of Reality, which is a global telecast. We just held it, originating from New York City. I flew here from there. It started at 6 p.m. Eastern time on Monday, went all the way around the clock, around the globe to hit the prime time hours in every time zone, and we concluded at 6 p.m. Eastern time on Tuesday. We had a half a billion homes that got the broadcast signal around the world. We had 32 million people view it online. We trended number one in both Facebook Live and YouTube. We had 5,000 people who were also broadcasting it over their own Facebook Live accounts. There's a whole new way of distributing this. And we had a huge response to it. And we just have to keep working to lift awareness. By the way, one of the people I interviewed on the program was the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico, Carmen Cruz, wonderful public servant.
Yeah.
And we had the president of Chile, Michelle Bachelet, who's fantastic, the new prime minister of New Zealand, who is really fantastic. I think she's got a global fan club now. And a lot of Governor Brown, lots of others. But the mayor of San Juan, she said, and I thought of this when you asked your question, they just completed a poll in Puerto Rico, which is, of course, devastated economically, and it's another story. But the number one concern of Puerto Ricans is the climate crisis.
Yeah.
And you can understand why. Hurricane Maria, they were also hit before that partly by Hurricane Irma. But there are a number of countries around the world where, unlike the United States, you give a list of 20 issues. Number one on the list is the climate crisis. And this global movement cannot be discounted. You know the old cliche, the train has left the station?
Mm-hmm.
The Paris Agreement, even with the asterisk that Donald Trump's tried to put on the U.S. participation unsuccessfully, the fact that all 197 nations in the world have unanimously agreed to go to net zero greenhouse gas pollution by mid-century or as soon thereafter as possible is a major, major development.
Mm-hmm.
The European oil companies are now making plans for, you know, a post-petroleum age. Mm-hmm. Every automobile manufacturer is moving quickly to electric vehicles. We're seeing massive changes in the investment community.
Yeah.
This is the seventh year in a row that global investments in renewable energy have exceeded the investments in fossil energy, and the gap keeps growing year by year. With the cost of batteries now coming down precipitously and the cost of solar in particular coming down so quickly, this is going to completely transform the world's energy system. Both in India and China, the cheapest electricity is now from solar and wind, not from, mm-hmm. from coal or gas. Mm-hmm. And so there is a lot of momentum.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features former Vice President Al Gore, whose latest book is an inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power, a companion to the documentary film of the same name. He's joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
India actually is an interesting example because at the point, and you'll see this in the movie, there were something like 300 million homes without electrical power.
Yeah.
But by virtue of their ability to go to renewable energy sources, right. It's kind of like the cell phone,
yeah.
Right?
Leapfrog. Yeah, if you don't have a nationwide telephone grid with the lines and poles, then why would you build one now? Right. I mean, I still have a landline phone, but I never answer it anymore because it's always a telemarketer.
Yeah, right.
And anybody who knows me is going to call me on my iPhone. And they are – we had somebody – we had a couple of people from Kenya on this 24-hour telecast. And the statistic is that 99% – of people in Kenya. I haven't checked this, but this was presented as a fact. 99% of people in Kenya have mobile phones now, and they use it for banking and financial services way more than we do. So that leapfrog, if a country doesn't have a landline electricity grid, again, why would you build one when you can have these microgrids fed by solar electricity and stored in batteries for use at night? And this is really sweeping the world now.
Yeah. One geopolitical issue is forget all the politics of this, with regard to our withdrawal from the Paris Accord, what is the opinion of other developed and developing nations about what's going on in the U.S.?
Well, those of you who've traveled overseas, and I travel too much, you've encountered the same thing I have, where there's a combination of puzzlement. What in the world has happened to the U.S.? Your politics seem to have gone stark raving mad. And there's an element of grief among those who so appreciated the leadership of the United States on behalf of democracy and and empowerment of individuals and tolerance and
human rights.
Enlightenment values, human rights, and there's a lot of confusion, concern, puzzlement, grief. But there's also now a recognition that this is an odd anomaly. There's a lot of hope that it won't persist. We're only 11 months into this experiment. In science and medicine, some experiments are terminated early for ethical reasons.
But your point about it's amazing how much you can say without saying it, isn't it?
I'm a recovering politician.
Yes, so. The What you said before about capital flow strikes me as really one of the most important metrics.
Yeah, because, yeah.
You know, you can, the EPA can do what they want with their website, right? They can take off any reference to climate change and so forth. But people who are investing capital, they're looking into the future.
They're not taking their cues from Scott Pruitt, for God's sake.
No, it's true.
In the investment world, well, here's one of the latest examples. One of the largest sovereign wealth funds in the world is in Norway, which, of course, was built with the wealth of, I mean, the fund was supplied with the wealth from the North Sea oil and gas fields. Mm-hmm. They just announced last month that they are cutting all of their investments in fossil fuels down to zero.
Wow.
And in France, you know, there are a lot of countries that are phasing out fossil fuels. France has announced that at a date certain, it's a, you know, a little ways off, but they are prohibiting any further exploration for fossil fuels in any territory controlled by France. Now we face the rush to explore for more oil and gas in the Arctic Ocean.
Right.
That is utterly insane.
And in Utah.
In this beautiful Grand Staircase Escalante wilderness area and the Bears Ears area, and an area where all the dinosaur bones are still being excavated.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of looking at the fossils, they want the fossil fuels. And the reality is that the world is facing a subprime carbon asset crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that phrase intentionally to draw an analogy to the subprime mortgage crisis.
That's a good phrase.
We have $28 trillion worth of fossil fuel reserves that have already been discovered, already been proven. They are on the books of multinational companies and sovereign owners, marked to market, on the assumption that they will all be put to their intended use and burned. But the International Energy Agency and the international scientific groups agree that no more than one-third, probably less, can ever actually be burned.
Yeah.
So two-thirds of it, with $22 trillion, is marked to, at a value on the books that is completely illusory.
Right.
And, of course, the subprime mortgages that triggered the credit crisis and then the Great Recession, they were marked on the books as if they were, well, they were given a AAA rating.
Right.
But then when some guy out here in Northern California looked
down,
you know,
at Stanford. Yeah.
Down at Stanford, started looking under the layers of the onion. Mm-hmm. He said, oh, my goodness, these are completely worthless.
Yeah.
They were 7.5 million of them were given to people who did not make a down payment, could not make the monthly payments. And the banking industry just convinced itself that if they I got my first mortgage as a young man sitting across the desk from a banker in Carthage, Tennessee, population 2,000, Mr. Birdwell asked me a long series of questions that were designed to build his confidence that I could make the monthly payments.
Yeah.
Well, there was none. If Walter Glenn Birdwell Jr. had looked at these subprime mortgages, he would say, well, what are you kidding me? Get out of here.
Yeah.
But obvious risk. But they convinced themselves, the large banks, that risk could be magically eliminated if they just bundled millions of them together, attached them to an illusory so-called insurance instrument, and sold them into the global markets.
Mm-hmm.
But the same thing happened when the international financiers took their cue from this guy at Stanford and started looking at, oh my God, and they just collapsed in value. The same thing is going to happen with $22 trillion of these subprime carbon assets. Mm-hmm. At some point, people would say, they're not going to be burned, so they can't be sold, so they don't have this value, so what are we going to do? That's why the Norwegian fund got out ahead of the crowd. That's why coal has lost 90% of its market capitalization in the last decade. And when the transportation market for petroleum disappears with electric cars, then the oil and that's being telescoped forward now. People are looking at that. By the way, new development in the heart of coal country in Kentucky. They have this big coal museum. They just installed solar panels on their roof. And I've got a picture of the before and after in my latest slideshow.
Good.
And they're saving $10,000 a year on their electric bill as a result.
Plus public health.
Plus public health, that's right.
Which is a cost factor we don't even seem to take into the equation when we talk about jobs. But there seems to be a theme, and that is for you to address more what I'll call the subnational efforts,
movement.
California, you say. Yeah. California, just to underscore this point, if it were a country, it would be the sixth or seventh largest country. So if we're members of the Paris Accord, that's pretty important.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you could address what's happening at the subnational level, because that's where a lot of the optimism comes.
I think. And justifiably so. By the way, here in San Francisco, next September, middle of September, Jerry Brown is hosting cities and states from all over the world who will come here to San Francisco to formalize a new stage of this subnational commitment on climate. And it's a very important movement.
And Rahm Emanuel. We want to get
Rahm Emanuel hosted the mayors in Chicago a couple of days ago, and they reiterated many of them, commitments they had made earlier, but they formalized it with a larger group.
Right.
Absolutely terrific leadership on Rahm's part. Former Mayor Mike Bloomberg from New York City has played an important role as well. For some reason that I don't fully understand, Roy, the politics of climate now seem to be very different at the municipal level and in a great many state and provincial governments. It's true all over the world. It may be that the phenomena known as policy capture, that is the ability of lobbyists and special interests to use lobbying and campaign financing and their legacy power and relationships to dominate national politics has not been replicated at the state and local level. They're trying. The Koch brothers have this ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. They groom young legislators. I'm not going to draw the analogy to other forms of grooming, but but it's tempting, isn't it?
Yeah.
and then they write the special interests actually write the legislation at the federal level. They're trying to do that locally, but local governments and state governments are resisting this. I think they're closer to the people and maybe not as dominated by these national special interests, but I'm encouraged by it.
Well, they're closer to where it's happening.
Yeah.
Right. Talk about the city in Texas, Georgetown.
Yeah. Right? You'll see it in the movie, but this is in the heart of oil country. It's a city of about 65,000 people, overwhelmingly voted for Trump. The mayor is a very conservative Republican, Trump-supporting mayor. He happens to be a CPA.
Yeah.
And he did the numbers and found that they could save a lot of money if they got off of fossil fuels and just went to 100% solar and wind. And so they did. And the electric bills have gone down. They're attracting new industry with the lower electricity rates. And it's become kind of a side benefit that they're helping to save the future of humanity.
Yeah. Right. And the fact he's a CPA probably helped a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? He knows something about balancing budgets and things like that.
In the aftermath of the movie, he's become a little bit like a media, somewhat of a media star. He's a great guy. He and I have become good friends. Yeah. I went back to Georgetown last month where the utility head of his utility invited me to come speak to all the utility people across the state of Texas that gathered there. And I said there hadn't been a breakout role like this since Jack Nicholson got on that motorcycle in Easy Rider.
Yeah. And, and so I just want to make a little speech on behalf of the audience, that one of the things that I find when I talk to my friends is missing in our world today is thought leaders. We don't have people who are willing to get out in front on an issue, and it may be inconvenient to tell the truth, but their people are willing to do it because they believe in it. And gradually, as with abolitionists and with the movement towards women's suffrage and with movements towards civil rights, it flips. And who knows why it flips, but it takes people to catalyze it. So on behalf of everybody here, I want to thank you
for being that. That's very nice of you. Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much. Yeah. Hope you enjoy the movie.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was former Vice President Al Gore, whose latest book is an inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power, a companion to the documentary film of the same name, directed by Bay Area filmmakers Bonnie Cohen and John Schenck. Al Gore was joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart. The recording engineers of the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.